What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh, it's okay. I've got an elegant new house across the park.
Across the park? Is that even Chicago?
It's only 5 stops on the subway. It's an elegant block, the filet of the neighborhood. We'll have a ping pong table.
Isn't that what WBEZ calls its late night weekend lineup, the filet of their broadcast schedule?
That's certainly what I call it.
Our top 5 this week, not meat metaphors, but movie narcissists. Jeff Daniels, Bernard from Noah Baumbach's The Squid and the Whale, he's a fine candidate.
He is indeed. Lots of good candidates for this top 5. Plus, we'll have an interview with Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman, the writer, director, and star, respectively, of the new film, Listen Up, Philip. That and more.
We still have to figure out what to do with the cat.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 2 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. To get 20% off only footage clips for new accounts, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1014.
We're also supported by Film Spotting listeners, including Scott in Portland, Oregon, $10 a month subscriber Justin in Birkdale, Australia. I think that's Queensland. Australia, Josh.
I think you're right.
And $5 a month subscriber, Adam in Columbia, Maryland, who sent us this nice note.
I only started listening to Film Spotting a few months ago per recommendation from a friend. Since then, I've become an avid listener and have begun making my way through your archived episodes. I teach a film director series focusing on Hitchcock, Wilder, and Hawks, and your discussions have inspired more than a few of my lectures. From one film buff to another, thank you.
Thank you, Adam. I have taught classes, Josh, on Wilder and Hawks myself. Hitchcock, I don't know that I'll ever really be cut out to teach a class on Hitchcock. So.
Next summer, UFC, put it on
the
schedule.
No, I am not ready to teach that class. Maybe you can co-teach it with me, Josh. Our thanks to Adam and to all of our listeners who supported us this week and every week. You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh, over the last month or so, we've devoted top 5 lists to movie bans. Last week, it was movie missives, our favorite movie letters or notes. A couple weeks ago, you and Michael Phillips even managed to come up with lists of your top 5 favorite manimals.
We did.
Finally, this week, a top 5 we can relate to, movie narcissists. The expectation that people will actually listen to us pontificate about narcissistic movie characters, not an irony that is lost on us. That top 5 is later in the show.
Speak for yourself. I identify more with the movie Manimals than narcissists. So
that's really disturbing. First up, though, my conversation with a couple guys who have played self-involved characters on screen, but couldn't have been more affable and generous with their time. Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman. Jason Schwartzman, of course, known to most everyone listening, I'm sure, for his work with Wes Anderson, including Rushmore, Moonrise Kingdom, and most recently, The Grand Budapest Hotel. Alex Ross Perry may be familiar to Film Spotting listeners as the writer, director, and co-star of 2012's The Color Wheel. It was a Golden Brick nominee here on the show as one of our favorite overlooked movies of the year. That was a comedy about a road-tripping and bickering brother and sister with, Josh, fair to say, a challenging ending?
Yeah, that's a good word
okay,
for it.
We'll go with challenging for now. In Perry's latest film, Schwartzman plays a self-involved young novelist who manages to push away almost everyone in his life, including his girlfriend, played by Elizabeth Moss. He's embraced only by Jonathan Pryce's jaded, once great writer, Ike Zimmerman. Philip, not a very likable character, but his dislikability might just be one of his most endearing qualities, which is where I started my conversation with Schwartzman and Perry. I think the funniest part of this film for me, and maybe the most uncomfortable, was watching characters, especially characters like Philip, who are just so unashamedly honest. And there are a lot of scenes we could point to, but maybe my favorite is the one during his office hours where the student asked for a letter of recommendation. And it made me think of how many times in our daily lives we have encounters like that, where it's almost easier to just do something reluctantly rather than come off as mean or aggressive. And Philip pretty much just says, I don't know you and your future isn't much concern to me. And I'm wondering if part of the pleasure of writing and making this movie was creating characters who are that blunt and that direct.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that pretty much every situation such as that one in the film comes from, you know, my desire to just be the guy who says exactly that in every opportunity. And of course, we cannot do that, but it was fun to sort of put Philip in a situation where every time he's given two choices, either the choice that is what you're kind of supposed to do or the thing that we would all rather do, he does the thing that people would rather do, which is, of course, a fairly standard and familiar idea in comedy, but I just wanted to have as much fun with that as possible, and that was sort of the way to approach every scene.
Jason, what about for you then, making those choices to play that character who says the things most of us think but aren't really willing to express?
Well, as Alex said, I mean, this is a guy who is giving people the business, and in our lives, you really can't do that as much as you would like, at least not in person. Most of the stuff is all face-to-face, and so I think that's also adds an element of this. But it was fun to be able to do it without any real repercussions, you know? It was a pleasure.
Hmm. That scene also provoked for me my biggest laugh in the movie, and maybe definitely one of the biggest laughs during any movie this year. The line that you punctuate the scene with, here's a piece of paper with some staples in it, and you hand her that piece of paper. The randomness of that line and that kind of gesture of casual disdain, I'm just curious, was that in the script the whole time, or did that come out of the moment somehow?
I'm sorry to say on my own behalf that is 100% a Jason addition.
Well, I would say that it was that stapler was there, and it made a great sound when you put the paper in it, and it was more that it was just there, and it was fun to play with.
Well, you can kind of...
It wasn't like a, you know, it would be great to have a stapler there.
Yeah.
No, certainly not, but at that point in the filming, we were certainly in the groove enough that Jason knew that if he gets into a room and there's a stapler on a desk, and it's a scene where he's meant to be irritating, he should feel completely comfortable just making as much noise as he wants. And, you know, there's a half dozen other improvised lines that we could have plugged in anywhere into that scene. But I actually remember I was watching that scene in the theater just last night, and there's a little speech that Philip gives that I remember, you know, presented some difficulty for some reason. It was just a series of lines that, you know, you just were like, this is a really hard, like, four sentences to get out. And they're in the movie exactly word for word the way they were. And then the final moment in the scene and the one everyone remembers the most was just something that you tossed on there after the sort of relief of finally getting those few lines out.
Yes, that's true. For some reason, that was a hard... I just struggled there getting those lines.
Look, I'll say this and then we can proceed accordingly. Number one, internships are a waste of time, so you shouldn't bother. Two, that company sucks and you wouldn't gain any worthwhile experience there. And three, I don't actually think that I know you very well. Or at all, now that I think about it. So I wouldn't be the best person to sing your praises. Where does that leave us on the whole letter of recommendation tip?
I think they can be somewhat generic. It's kind of a formality anyway.
Nah.
Does your publisher have an internship program?
To be honest with you, I have no idea. I'm not thinking about this right now. Here's a piece of paper with some staples in it. Wish I could be of more help.
You can see when you cut to the close-up of the actress in the scene and her eyes following his hand with the stapler, almost like, what is he doing? Not to belabor it too much, but is that something that you captured only once, or after you saw it, did you go back and try to refine it and get it right, so to speak?
That was something that I know for a fact. That, you know, that was one of the examples where when you have a moment that you end up with that was not scripted and is something that an actor sort of gave you on one take, it becomes a little bit of a game to figure out whether or not you can actually use it without totally betraying any sort of editing. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes you're going to have something that has no filmed reaction to it. Mm-hmm. So that was something we wanted to really fight for, and I think we finally got that scene in shape so that it would support additional moments.
In your recent interview and film comment, you were asked about how much you personally relate to some of the characters or any of the characters in the movie. And you were talking about specifically the relationship between Philip and Ashley, Elizabeth Moss's character. And you said this: I hope that by watching them play off one another, I will learn how to balance these different sides of myself. And that struck me because I'm always fascinated by the idea of art serving any kind of practical function for people who are consuming it or producing it. Does exploring those sides of yourself on screen have a discernible effect on you, your personality, your relationships, or is that more of something like an ideal you're hoping, you're striving for?
Geez, I don't know. That's a pretty big question.
It is, yeah.
I mean, the whole reason behind spending 2 years making a movie, writing it, spending months talking about it 1,000 times, and then sitting with it and then talking about it over and over once it's out. You know, to me, the only reason to go through that is because you have questions that you can't answer otherwise. And whatever the individual movie is, whatever questions were fueling the creation of that particular movie, you know, by the end of it, you get to the point, if you're lucky, if I'm lucky, and I have been so far, where, you know, my goals of making the film and what I hope to learn by making it are generally quite fulfilled. So I would say at this point, yes, I do. I have gained quite a bit from watching these things play off one another.
Jason, have you, with films you've made or watched, had that kind of reaction, or maybe books or albums, have they fundamentally altered you and how you relate to others or view the world?
There's no question that books and movies and, I mean, that's been my, and records, I mean, absolutely fundamentally altered me. I mean, on every level that you could have, I mean, I learned how to shave from watching The Graduate, because he shaves in that movie so often, and I didn't know how to shave, so I would watch that, like, you know, I was sort of like paying attention to how he would shave, and I just, so from that level to, you know, every other type of thing, even if it's not changing you, at least sometimes you see something play out that it's speaks for you in a way, and you say, that's the feeling I've sort of been, I didn't know that I had, or that's it, that someone just sort of did it, they made an example of it, and that's great. And you really feel that a lot of times. Like, I don't read nearly as much as Alex does, but when you read a sentence that's so beautiful, that seems like the most mysterious thing to me of all, because how did they just take all those words that we all use in our everyday life, but they somehow put them in an order that you couldn't ever think to do, and it made it all make some sense to you. It's an amazing thing, for sure.
Yeah, there are moments like that in this film with the voiceover narration, I would say, for sure, where I had that reaction, just reacting to kind of the beauty of the words being strung together in that moment. But speaking of speaking for you, Alex, you are an actor in addition to a writer and director, and you co-starred in The Color Wheel, your previous film, obviously. Did you consider casting yourself again here, or did you kind of know always from the beginning that this film needed something a little bit different, something that an actor like Jason can bring?
Well, I would debate the, you know, categorization of myself as an actor. I would say that I was in The Color Wheel. I would not say that I'm an actor. I would certainly not say that after having made a film with professional actors whose craft and process is so intensely mannered and understood by them that it made me understand absolutely what the difference is between non-actors and professional actors, to the extent that it's almost insulting to even like say, you know, oh yeah, the actors in this movie sometimes, because it's like, no, like Jason, Elizabeth, Jonathan Price, like these are actors. I am not that. And that was, you know, and knowing that and really having not enjoyed any part of the process of pulling, you know, double duty or quadruple duty, whatever I had to do on The Color Wheel, being in front of the camera and sort of directing from within the scene and directing from the other side of the camera is very stressful for me. And obviously, you know, there are many incredibly heroic filmmakers who can do it, you know, equal splendor. And watching, you know, a Cassavetes film that he's in, you don't think, man, this directing is really half-assed. He clearly is dividing his attention, but he's, you know, on Mount Rushmore, and I'm not. So it's just really not something that I feel particularly qualified to be doing. And I learned that every scene in anything that I was also acting in, what that was my favorite scene was always a scene that I wasn't in. And I just, you know, knowing that, I couldn't make this movie. I couldn't handicap it by putting myself in front of the camera, and I really never wanted to do it. So even if this was, you know, a $50,000, you know, micro-budget movie made with friends, I would have done everything possible to never have to be in it at all.
But that said, one thing that was really, for me, you know, when I read the script, it was so well written, and when we're talking about, you know, sentences and stuff, as you say in the narration that you heard, heard some beautiful language, and in the script too, it was a great amount of care had gone into writing it, and things that you like that you will never see. I mean, descriptions of things that almost like would make you think that they were going to become a major part of the movie, and they didn't. It was just like, but he gave everything so much attention in the writing of it, and it was a big script and complicated, and I didn't feel that I could be in this movie if I was sort of left to my own devices, or I don't know what the right word is, but I just sort of felt like I can't do this movie alone. I don't have a skill set to do this as an actor by myself. I need help, and that's why I was so excited and nervous also to meet Alex. I hoped that we were going to have a great rapport, and I felt like we did instantly, but I was so nervous. But one thing I will say that was nice was that he had at least, he doesn't say he's an actor, I think he is, but the fact that he was in a movie did also make me feel like, okay, we can do this. You know what I mean? I felt connected to him in a way. Before I'd met him, just like, he's acted. He knows what that's like. He's been in scenes. He's played in scenes. I mean, this is nice for me. And I don't think I've ever really worked with a director who's been in movies. So even though he says that an actor, that was a key thing for me too, was just the fact that he had that experience.
You mentioned that rapport and hope it translates to the screen. I can say that I got the sense watching the film that I would have assumed you guys had known each other for years, and somehow that translated to the screen, and that obviously wasn't the case.
Well, it was so nice because he gave me so much of his time. It was the ultimate luxury. It was coming to New York about a month before we started shooting, and you know, this is the time when a director, it's like crunch time. They're going on location, you know, wardrobe, so many meetings and things, and he always gave me time. And that was so nice because we could think out loud and make bad jokes or make mistakes or go on tangents and show each other movies and talk about things. And it was so beneficial, and it was the best. And, you know, I think also it was funny because, you know, I remember specifically a long, long time ago when I was on tour with my old band, we had an inside joke that had just become an inside joke, just as they all do, by accident. But it became such an inside joke for so long that I remember getting off tour and going to have food with my brothers and stuff, and I made the inside joke, and they didn't even not laugh, if that makes sense. They didn't even know it was supposed to be funny, and then give me a face that's not funny. They just kept looking at the menu, and I was like, oh, wow. I didn't realize how far off I am. You know, I didn't even consider that.
Uh-huh.
And in a way, I remember a couple weeks after Alex and I had been together every day, talking about the movie every day or thinking about it or whatever, Elizabeth Moss came and joined us, and we were getting to know all of each other and laughing and talking about the movie and how excited we all were. And I think at some point she said something about how Philip treated Ashley, and I kind of took it personally and was like, well, you or Ashley is not exactly doing it. And I started to like defend it, Philip.
Mm-hmm.
And it was weird because then I realized, oh my, what am I doing? And we kind of got in this like debate, a friendly debate about the stuff. And then I was like smiling, kind of going like, well, I cannot believe I am like actually arguing for this, but I really don't see your point. but I do because it's crazy, but I don't because, and it was just a thing where, like, I think Alex and I got so close so quickly and so close to the material so quickly that it just became like, it just snuck up, I think, on, mm-hmm. on me at least. Because I remember feeling very negative towards a lot of people while we were making that movie.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing inside jokes and craft and process with director Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman. Their new film is Listen Up, Philip. We've touched on, obviously, how arrogant and difficult the Philip character can be, but he is charming to a degree. And I think the best way I can put it maybe is that he's at least aware, I think, of how terrible he can be, which counts for something, and he does it in a way, or you do it in a way, without, I think, winking at the audience. And I don't think he takes particular pleasure in hurting others. It's just who he is. So how do you sort of try to capture that and bring that all to the screen?
Well, you know, there's another great line in the film that I love. There was a Jason edition, but at one point, you know, he's being difficult at a photo shoot, and he starts walking away, and just when the audience realizes that this is probably what they're thinking, Jason turns to the characters and to the audience way and says, oh, what an asshole, right?
Right.
And I think that that's incredibly essential to keep in mind when thinking about the character, because to me, there's a big difference between the insulting, miserable, angry, funny guy who doesn't know that he's being insulting, miserable, angry, and funny, who just sort of is the way he is, and mm-hmm. everybody reacts to him. And then there's the guy who is 100% aware of the effect he has on a room and is completely in control of it and is not afraid to admit that he knows he's in control of it so that people don't think that he's just acting blindly. And I think that, you know, that the scene I'm referring to, by the way, was filmed on day 2 or 3, I think, of the shoot, really early. I think day 3, actually. And that, to me, Jason's idea to sort of throw that line in there proved already that after 3 weeks of sort of spending time in New York, that he had a complete understanding of what the character needed and where we needed to go with it and what sort of information it was our responsibility to pass along to the audience about what we, as the, you know, film construction crew, think of Philip. And that was actually the same day that we were doing another scene with Elizabeth, and we were talking about ways to do it, and she came up with this idea, and she said, yeah, I feel like this is pretty much what Jason would do if this scene was about him. And that was when she realized that she needed to be playing Ashley basically the exact same way Jason was playing Philip. And this day I learned that both of them understood the characters far better than I did.
Jason, that has to be an interesting balancing act, though, because if you try to soften him, the audience is going to catch on to that fact. And if you try to go too far into making him, you know, a total misanthrope, then we're going to see that as well.
Well, Alex and I talked about that, and there were times when we would, like, say, well, what about, is this line, what do you think about this? And any time there was any attempt to add anything or subtract something that would eventuate in him being more likable or sympathetic, or if that was like the goal, it only did a disservice to it, because the whole script and everything, it's extreme in its construction, and it's about that. I mean, it's about someone who is not doing these things, and so any attempt at that only made him seem very passive aggressive. You know, it was just kind of like sticking a bunch of smile stickers on something that's not smiling, and it just made it worse. So there's something so nice about Philip's just directness and you know, and his honesty, I guess. So you always know where you are with him.
Alex, the characters here, obviously, as we were talking about language, are writers. There's a couple of them in this movie, so they're going to be naturally a little bit obsessed with words and how things are phrased. And there's a great line. There's a scene with Kristen Ritter, the daughter to the Jonathan Pryce character, and he talks about the innate ineffability of human disappointment overcomes my faith every time. And he chastises his daughter for belittling him, and I couldn't quite get the exact phrasing down. Jonathan Pryce is speaking very fast there as I was trying to get the line, but he talks about her reinforcing his disconnect from the people around him and saving myself from future disappointment by cutting myself off to the extent that I did. And it's very hurtful, but it's also in a way confounding and a little bit oblique, and in contrast to some of the directness and bluntness of their more daily interactions. And I was wondering if you were in some of these scenes trying to capture the way people like this can over-intellectualize their emotions, maybe be too self-aware almost to a fault.
Well, I don't know if it's really self-awareness, because what you have in the scene that you're referring to, you know, as you pointed out, it is the Ike character sort of, in a way, laying it all out and saying, here's who I am, here's how I operate, here's what I try to do, and here's how everybody else in the world prevents me from actually doing that. And you don't really, or at least I hope you don't, doubt that he believes that. What the conversation should become is this really true? Going back to what Jason was just saying about our conversations on set about, you know, should Philip do this or should he say something that makes him more passive-aggressive? There were a lot of times where Jason would say, and then this scene with Jonathan that we're talking about right now is another good example of that, where Jason would say, is this really what Philip believes, or is he saying this for the benefit of what he thinks somebody else wants to hear,
mm-hmm.
or what he thinks they need to hear? And, you know, almost always the answer was like, no, he really believes this. You know, there was a couple examples where he was like, you know, well, if the answer is that he really believes this, then the way people should respond to him is like, Jesus, I can't believe that's what this guy walks around thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And this scene with Jonathan is a great example of that, because if he said, does Ike really believe this, or if he's just saying this to hurt his daughter,
mm-hmm.
I would say, no, he truly, absolutely believes all of this to be true, that he believes that he sees everything, that he's above it all, and that he is always the one who's trying to give people a second chance, and that they just disappoint him. This is actually Ike's philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and he's not saying this to be hurtful. It's just hurtful for someone to actually listen to this and think, I cannot believe this is what this person actually operates under the, mm-hmm. the belief of. And that was a lot of fun with those two characters to just sort of see where that chronological endpoint is of, you know, Jesus, is that what this guy really walks around thinking all the time? And in the case of this one scene between father and daughter, the answer is, yeah, that really is what I think.
I always try to lead by example to show everyone how I can put aside preconceptions and find new feelings, new ideas. But the innate ineffability of human disappointment overcomes my faith every time. So when you belittle me...
Belittle you? Why didn't you say anything to
yes.
you? Yes! What are you talking
belittle
about?
Belittle me! For my self-made disconnect from those who want nothing from me but to further their own petty feelings of self-delusion. Then you reinforce the degree to which I save myself from future disappointment by cutting myself off to the extent that I did.
We'll return to Adam's interview with Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman in just a bit. Plus, Adam and I will seek more of the spotlight by casting ourselves in Massacre Theater. Stay with us. Quick reminder here, folks, that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project.
And I don't have a next creative project right now, Josh, but I went there nevertheless, thinking of our themes this week. I typed in narcissist. I got 16 HD footage clips, mostly of people taking selfies.
Oh, sure.
So
that
I think
makes
that's
sense.
A little bit of commentary on social media there. I also typed in narcissus. 801 footage clips came back, most of them of a flower.
Well, there you go.
Were you aware that a narcissus is a spring perennial?
I knew it was a flower, but not that variety.
Not there at Shutterstock. Zero results for any footage of Peter Gabriel with Genesis in the 70s, dressed up like a flower, singing about narcissus in one of the greatest songs ever written, Supper's Ready. 26 minutes long, Josh.
Wow. I'm going to take your word for
that. That's not there, unfortunately, but I think that that may be the first of two Genesis references I'm going to get into this week's show.
Yes, it is.
I'm going for it.
And I think we're done with those.
Oh, no. Come on. Shutterstock, of course, offers you more than 2 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics for whatever you're working on, whether it's your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or other type of film project. Those clips come in a variety of digital formats, from lower resolution for web use to HD, and now some come in 4K. They offer flexible pricing. You can choose individual clips or get a video pack for the best deal. And as you find the video assets you're looking for, you can save them to a clip box, then just access those selections anytime and share them with others.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account. Begin browsing Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Then save video selections that you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1014, and new accounts will receive 20% off only footage clips. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off any video clips with a new account, use offer code FILM1014. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. I'm a hard worker. I set high goals. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. So what do you say? I could start tomorrow, or even why not tonight?
No, I'm not hiring.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's a clip from the trailer for the upcoming movie Nightcrawler. It opens on October 31st. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a man who is desperate for work and, according to my notes, Josh, gets caught up in the high-speed world of L.A. crime journalism. And, well, things get a little bit messy from there. I've seen this trailer now a couple times, and I'm very excited to see what we get from Gyllenhaal and from this movie. It's written and directed by Dan Gilroy, who people may know from his work as a screenwriter. He wrote the movie The Fall. He also wrote The Bourne Legacy more recently. And one of the reasons we're highlighting Nightcrawler here, we'll probably discuss it, we're planning to anyway, on an upcoming show, but we're also, for our Chicago-based listeners, giving away free passes. We love to give away free movie passes.
Been doing
a
lot of this lately.
Yeah, it's very nice to have that opportunity to give those out. And as I mentioned, it opens on October 31st here in Chicago, but there's an advanced screening on Tuesday night, October 28th. That's the screening we're giving away passes to. So all the information you need about entering to win those passes is available at filmspotting.net. It's right there in the top story section. Also at our website, if you haven't already participated in our poll question, we think one of our best poll questions in a long time. We hope you will go and do it now. It was inspired by the movie we plan to discuss next week on the show, a film that's only been gaining momentum since its prize-winning debut at Sundance this past January. The movie's Whiplash, with Miles Teller as an ambitious young drummer and J.K. Simmons plays his sadistic instructor. Our poll question asks you to imagine yourself, you've been given the power to direct a small-budget movie. I don't know how much power there is in that, but
you also have casting. You have
some casting power, which is always important. And you're looking for a great character actor in his 40s/50s. So think of guys like J.K. Simmons and peers such as John Hawkes, Ben Mendelsohn, Michael Shannon, who just turned 40. We should note we got called out on that, rightfully. We tried to make him in his 50s.
He's not quite there
on our
yet,
last show.
He?
No, he's not really that close like the rest of these guys. Like Jeffrey Wright, another very talented character actor. So despite the fact that Michael Shannon is the youngin' of the group, we're still including him. And don't worry, we've also already been called out for overlooking guys like Richard Jenkins and Paul Giamatti. So you know what? We're flawed.
Did we give
our questions
him
are flawed.
Other option or not?
No other. No,
oh,
we really
okay.
just wanted
so.
You to pick between those five guys.
Forcing choices here.
It's not asking you who's the greatest male character actor
you've
in his 50s
choose.
At the
you've
time.
You've got to
choose. You have to pick one of those five guys, and it is tough enough without any other options. We hope you'll go and vote and maybe even leave a comment over at filmspotting.net.
And for the record, you went with the 58-year-old Michael Shannon.
Yes.
And I went with John Hawks.
You went with Hawks, and I went with the guy who doesn't belong in the poll.
Okay.
So speaking of more flaws, and that's a perfect segue into a correction.
Oh, correction time.
Yes, it is correction time.
Do we have correction music yet?
We don't have correction music yet.
Oh, man.
And that hopefully is because we don't make enough mistakes, if only that were true. But Stephen in Provo, Utah wrote in Josh with this.
Kim Dickens, not Kim Dickey, is the actress who portrays Gone Girl's Detective Boney. Perhaps Adam was merely conglomerating her name with her character name, or perhaps he still has an affinity for Dale Dickey from Winter's Bone.
That was really Maddie, who particularly loved Dale Dickey,
okay. But
very good performance from Winter's Bone, yes.
Or perhaps Stephen says he was concentrating too hard on getting Fincher's name right that he slouched on Dickens.
So you'll get that, of course, if you listen to the podcast and you stayed all the way to the end of the show to hear the outtake where I proceeded to call David Fincher David Lynch, I think three times.
I think it was just twice.
Oh, okay.
I think the third time you got it.
I avoided it the third time.
And I had obviously exhausted my monitoring capabilities by correcting you a couple of times, and I just couldn't correct you on Dickens either.
You know, the thing about Dickens that's kind of funny is most of the time those mistakes are made because you don't look it up ahead of time. You go off of memory.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that actress's name. I remember liking her performances quite a bit in Tremé, the series on HBO, but I never had paid attention to what the actress's name was. I had to look it up right before recording. That's the great
You're
irony of this. I literally looked it up.
Hole here.
And somehow my eyes saw Dickey, not Dickens. And I do think it might be because I was conflating it with her character's
Could
name,
be.
Which is Boney. So there you go. Thank you, Stephen, for calling me out. My apologies to Miss Dickens. Our bonus content, we are going to give you a little bit of feedback, your responses to one of our recent top fives. We talked about the movie Frank starring Michael Fassbender, and we shared our top five movie bands. This is some feedback we've been looking forward to getting to for a little while. If you don't already have the Film Spotting app, you can get it for your iPhone or Android device. All the information you need is at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps. It is now time to turn to Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, we massacred this.
Hey, Gasway! Future, stop it!
Right now.
Oh, what? Are you threatening me? Because I think I can take you.
Excuse me?
You heard me.
I couldn't hear you from all the way over there.
I can take you because you have one fatal flaw.
Oh, I want to hear it.
No, you don't. You can't take criticism.
Try me.
Can't take it.
What's my flaw?
Your temper. It gets the best of you. Makes you weak. Makes you vulnerable.
That was Ron Perlman as Hellboy and the voice of Seth MacFarlane as Johan in 2008's Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, which was written and directed by Guillermo del Toro. On episode 508, we shared some recommendations for the Chicago International Film Festival, which runs until October 23, and we also shared our top five Chicago Film Fest discoveries. Del Toro's 2001 horror movie, The Devil's Backbone, that was one of my picks.
It was funny because a little bit of behind-the-scenes banter here. You emailed me this option, and I said, I have no relationship to this movie
this
whatsoever.
Right.
Why would we do
Very
this
Very disdainfully.
Scene? Well, I don't know about
I
that.
I could sense
but
the disdain between the letters in the email.
And then it hit me one day. I don't know why, but just out
great.
Of the blue, it hit me. And I went to filmspotting.net. I went to the little search bar. I typed in Hellboy 2, and sure enough, reviewed here on the show. And yes, I was part of that conversation. So as I recall, I liked the movie.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Were you were positive?
Yeah, I was positive.
It, but not positive enough to,
to remember it
some 5 years later.
That is the case. And that really was the only tie-in. I think for once we stumped our listeners, Josh, because we didn't get any other amazing connections that we didn't think about.
Yeah, I certainly didn't have any others.
But Jefferson Hyde in Seattle, Washington, is a very clever listener who likes to partake in the Massacre Theater fun, and he wrote in with this. I actually thought Adam's performance was quite good. By retreating into his feminine bailiwick, Adam was highlighting the fact that Johan Kraus was not simply lecturing Hellboy about his temper, but was actually undermining the entire male macho attitude that defines his persona.
Wow.
You're the only one who gets me, Jefferson.
Yes.
It's a clear-cut case of choosing thematic resonance over technical acting proficiency, and I applaud it as such. You know why that is? Because I have no technical acting proficiency.
But I can't see you overthinking a Massacre Theater
for
performance.
Sure. This isn't to shortchange Josh, however.
Oh,
just when
you.
I was in danger of getting lost in Adam's high-concept interpretation of the scene, in chimes Josh with a damn near perfect Perlman, pulling me back to the realization that I was listening to Hellboy 2 and not Gloria Steinem's memoir. Josh was, in essence, playing the straight Hellboy to Adam's more experimental Krauss. Wow. Josh Larson playing the straight man. I never thought it would happen, but there you go. Excellent work, both of you.
Well, we do like to mix it up. What can we say?
Thank you, Jefferson. If you want to hear the rendition of that scene from Hellboy 2, along with all the other stuff we discussed on episode 508, you can find that episode at filmspotting.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Josh, it seems, though, despite your bang-on Perlman and my brilliant rendition of Johan and feminine rendition of Johan, that stumped most of our
really
listeners.
Really did it. So a lot of other people forgot they saw Hellboy 2, apparently.
I think so, maybe. They just didn't see it because we had a very low, low turnout.
Too bad.
Not brimming at all, but you're going to reach into the film spotting hat anyway and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Joshua Heiser from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Congratulations, Joshua. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own film spotting t-shirt.
To the cannoli line.
Max, you're supposed to say forget about it, Sanchez. The old man likes his cannoli.
Look, I made a mistake, all right? It didn't make any difference anyway.
Hey, I'm letting it go. But don't say it doesn't matter. Every line matters.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and if only you all could have heard the direction Josh just gave me.
There was a lot of preparation for this scene.
Yeah,
we
usually don't prep
at
all, but for this one, and you'll probably understand why, we had to put in a little bit of work. I don't know if that's going to translate
probably
to our rendition of the scene, but there have been a lot of firsts over the years with Massacre Theater. There's been the music scenes where we actually brought in a guitar and we sang. There's been the scenes where we've tried to do some sound effects. I think this is a first. I don't think we've ever gone with
these types of sound effects
right. Well, before.
Let's see how it goes.
Oh, man.
Could become a trend.
It's not going to go well. You started off. I'm going to give you the action. We're not going to give you any other hints. It ties in with something we're discussing or someone we're discussing on this week's show.
There you go.
Okay. And action.
In summation, I think you just got to not do it, man. That's all.
I understand what you're saying, and your comments are valuable, but I'm going to ignore your advice.
The cuss you are.
The cuss am I? Are you cussing with me?
No. You cussing with me?
Don't cussing point at me.
If you're going to cuss with somebody,
you're not
going to cuss with me, you little cuss.
Just buy the tree.
Okay.
And scene.
I think it worked.
We nailed that.
You know, I'm pretty proud during Massacre Theater not to spit a lot, but I think things got a little messy this time.
A little out of control that time, but I think it only added to the performance and the emotion of the scene, Josh. We were perfectly in sync, and we didn't actually practice the scene.
No rehearsal. We discussed it, did not rehearse.
Not one lesson. Just like Ferris Bueller, that's us with Massacre Theater. If you know what scene we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, October 27th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
My uncle, who you saw in passing, raised me because both my parents were killed in a car accident.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I want you to contextualize my sadness. Put whatever you're going through into perspective. My mom was pregnant at the time. 7 months. I was on the news. I'm telling you this to hurt you right now, because you're trying to make me feel bad. Horrible, even. Which I don't appreciate. But I never will. Because nothing ever feels bad once you learn what that emotion is capable of.
Another scene there from Listen Up, Philip, the new movie starring Jason Schwartzman, written and directed by Alex Ross Perry. In part one of my interview with Perry and Schwartzman, we were talking about how self-aware almost every character in this movie is. And that led me to a question for Alex about how he has talked so openly about his influences. And if you've read even one or two Philip Roth novels, as I have, you see his markings all over this movie. Certainly a movie like Woody Allen's Husbands and Wives, which is a film I love, that's very evident here, that influence. He's clearly a filmmaker and a film lover, and I wondered if those references and those artistic touchstones for Alex were ever burdens for him. Is he ever concerned about not saying something personal and unique because of those influences?
It's not a huge concern because, you know, I'm very comfortable admitting, and I'm not going to hide and say that, you know, oh no, you know, these things aren't very important to me. You know, if something's important to me, I'll say it's important to me just because, one, I want to own what has inspired me, and two, it can only help, you know, if someone gets turned on to something. If I'm 15 years old and I'm getting into cinema and I hear a director of a movie I just enjoyed say, these are my three biggest influences, I'm probably seeking out those films myself. And then one of those might become my new favorite director because, you know, that's the way things work. So I'm very comfortable saying that. But, you know, talking about, you know, the influence of Woody Allen and the stylistic, you know, splendor of Husbands and Wives that was really influential to the cinematography and color palette and art direction of this film. Once you get that into your head, to me, if it's something that you really feel honestly and you're not a fraud who just sort of is looking for references to build out what mm-hmm. you think will make you sound intelligent, if you really honestly and emotionally connect with something, then you don't need to really look at it in order to be inspired by it. Because mm-hmm. if you look at it, you're just going to be copying it. And if you just sort of vaguely remember, you know, what about it was meaningful to you for this project, and yeah, maybe you put a DVD in and then look at a clip or two here or there, and, you know, if necessary, you sit down and rewatch the whole thing. But if you're just able to look at it with the right blinders on, and you're not looking at it to copy, you're just looking at it to understand what this movie makes you feel like or what this novel makes you feel like, mm-hmm. and trying to guide your own work, in my case, to something that feels the same, because I'm not trying to rip off a rhythm of dialogue from Husbands and Wives or the pace of editing or anything. I'm just trying to make something that makes me feel the way that movie makes me feel, and that could be any number of things. Because otherwise, you're just sort of talking about this sort of like dangerous line between actually liking cinema and cinephilia, where you're just watching things to file them away for some sort of reference that you're never going to actually have any emotional connection to. Whereas, you know, I've come to be very comfortable just admitting that, you know, I like watching movies because they make me feel less alone. I like watching them because they're entertaining and because I like being entertained. And anything that they inspire in me is emotional first, thought-provoking second, mm-hmm. and academic never.
Jason, I want to ask you about specifically the sort of process once Alex says action, that relationship to the camera on a film like this. I don't know how unique it was for you, but I'm guessing there have probably been times on set where the camera is at enough of a distance where maybe temporarily you can almost believe that it's not really there and you're just acting out this scene. But the camera here, very tight, very much in your face all the time. I'm guessing the way it was kind of roaming scene to scene, you weren't always quite sure what it was even going to capture in a given moment. What's that like for you as an actor relating to the camera?
Well, it was great, and that's the way Alex wanted to do it, and Sean wanted to do it, and part of what goes into that is making the environment one that runs the risk of being on camera at any moment. And so for that reason, whenever possible, it was like no one really in the room except Alex and Sean and a boom mic, if that sometimes, and a place like Ike's house, which was a home in upstate New York. Really, I've never done a play, really, but it felt like we were doing a play in that we could walk around and you could go into another room and the camera could go there with you. I mean, a lot of times, as I'm sure you know and people would know, it's just that if you walk 2 feet to the left of what the frame is, there's a bunch of cables and things like that. So this was not like that. This was more like it was a home that we were staying in as these people sort of, you know, not literally, but we could walk around and you could just go to any room. And also Sean was very free sometimes to do things like specifically, and he was doing things, by the way, that you don't even really know he's doing. Like there's a scene in the movie when Philip and Yvette are first really talking and they're having a cigarette in the rain, and there's a shot where she lights a match, or it's a lighter, I forget, but anyway, she lights a cigarette for Philip and inhales, and so the camera follows that and then follows the smoke out of my mouth. It looks so figured out, and that was just Sean kind of grabbing that.
Wow.
And
the relevant phrase that he coined that night, screaming angrily at sound guys in the rain, was that they're sitting inside comfortably in a chair and he's out in the rain chasing the image, which was a legendary phrase before we even looked at that footage already. Yeah. And yeah, when we looked at that footage in the edit room, I said, oh yeah, this is the night that Sean said chasing the image. Our editor said, yeah, well, guess what? He found it.
Yeah, he definitely
only
did.
That smoke from the light from Jason's hand and the cigarette and the smoke to Josephine and then up to her mouth on the line and then back down to her hands. It's just, you know, it's that's improvisation. That's not something that's verbal or in a performance. That's just him improvising because of where he sees the moment going.
Huh. Exactly. So it's an example like that where everyone's, when they say action, everyone is working, and he is an actor too, you know, essentially. And we're all in close quarters and moving around each other. And it was wonderful because, as you say, like, I mean, there are, obviously are some more traditional types of things where, well, we're getting this person's close up and this person's, but and there were moments like that when we were shooting. But for the most part, I do sort of recall, as you ask, and I hadn't really thought about it, but where you're just doing, I mean, not like you're slack, like reading People magazine while someone else is close up and you're saying your lines, but there is like you know, at all times you are ready for the camera to spin around. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was great.
Last question for you guys. I really do appreciate all of your time here. I'd be remiss, though, if I didn't pose this question to you guys. We are inspired by Listen Up, Philip, on the show this week doing our top five movie narcissists. And considering you guys are both such cinephiles, and, of course, I'm talking to the guy who was Max Fisher, I have to throw that challenge out to you. Any immediately come to mind from movies you love?
Well, you know, Going back to some of the stuff that we would sit down and watch, a big one for me is a major inspiration for Listen Up, Philip, and a perfect film that answers your question is Maurice Pilaf's We Won't Grow Old Together, which is like Listen Up, Philip, a depiction of the sort of destructive effects that a creatively driven person has on their own life. And the main character is a documentary filmmaker. And, you know, this character could not be a better answer to your question. So there's one, and a highly recommendable film.
Yeah, and also wonderful because, you know, Alex was knew the film. I had never seen it, and it's nice to see an example of something. You know, sometimes, you know, we were talking about seeing things and influences, and I do believe that, you know, you don't just like go, oh, let me go watch that for this exact reason all the time. But sometimes it's like an example, you know, if I haven't seen it, it's different. If Alex is saying, well, it's like this, but I'm not going to go rewatch. But it's, you know, when you haven't seen something, it was so, you see an example and so much in it that you just see that you really can't describe. It's just seeing it. There it is. So in terms of like who I would say, I can't. I feel like that's so much pressure. But I will say that, Alex, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember buying a book right before we started shooting called The Wizard of Oz and Other Narcissists, and it was all about narcissism and using, like, examples of The Wizard of Oz and stuff, and I was thinking, well, maybe The Wizard of Oz is pretty good, but I don't really have a great answer, right? Because the one I was going to give you was the one Alex just did.
Well, that was,
I mean, you know, it's fun. Maybe someday I get to put together, like, a little screening series of, you know, films that you would look at the main character and you would see Philip in them. But, you know, I mean, I'm just sitting here in my living room looking at my DVDs and, like, it'll be fun to, you know, I will, you know, next week we have I programmed a few films when the film opens, and one of the movies screening is Magnificent Ambersons, which I selected because I wanted people to sort of think about its use of narration. But, you know, the character played by Eric Holt in that film is kind of an amazing example of this narcissist who sees the world as revolving around him, and, you know, obviously the legendary quotations from the film and the big buzzword from it, you know, that's easy to remember is comeuppance.
Yep.
I comeuppance is an idea that I was thinking about quite a bit, of course, when writing the ending of Listen Up, Fill Up. So that would be a fun one to sort of see side by side, which, you know, people go see the program next week at Movies I Selected, they'll get to experience. But, you know, I mean, then you just look at, like, other examples of this, like, a film I really love, like Brian De Palma's Blowout. Like, mm-hmm. you know, John Travolta in that film is consumed by this sort of obsession and this passion. And, you know, does that make him a narcissist? Does that mean that he doesn't see anything in the world outside of himself? Does that mean he's obsessed with himself? Or, you know, that film's kind of a mystery. So it unravels in a different way. And what's become interesting to me is kind of looking at the different ways that people respond to what I perceive as very similar characters in different types of films. So if we were making, you know, a film that was a little bit less of a realistic piece, you know, our film is a character drama, if we're making a film that is sort of a mystery or a thriller, now it would be okay for Philip to be someone who shuts the entire rest of the world out and is entirely driven, because then you see him as this sort of, you know, professional on a mission who has to just shut out the people in his life in order to do his job. Because the film is grounded in reality, we don't really get away with as much as you might if Philip actually had something to do, something to justify the way he treats these people other mm-hmm. than because he feels like it. So it's interesting to kind of look at that sort of attitude in different films and the way that it appears differently. You know, I started talking a little bit about how I wanted this film to sort of address some of the same questions that I saw being dealt with really excellently in Holy Motors. In the sense that both films basically ask what happens when you leave the room. You know, Listen Up, Philip, what happens to Ashley when Philip says, I'm going away for the semester? Well, I made the choice that we stay with Ashley for a while and we find out. Holy Motors is an entire film that looks at the same sort of narcissism. Does the entire world exist only for you? When someone leaves the room from talking mm-hmm. to you, do they change their outfit, adopt a different persona and go interact with somebody different in a totally different manner? You know, that film, no one would say, oh, this character's a narcissist, because it's much more oblique in its approach to these issues. But these are all things that I do find very compelling. And, mm-hmm. you know, a major hero, favorite filmmaker of mine is Paul Schrader. So, like, character in American Gigolo, is he a narcissist? Well, probably. He's beautiful and he's obsessed with himself.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that movie's fun and it's sexy. So maybe he can get away with a bit more than we can.
Yeah.
The style of that film is narcissistic, and therefore we're all invited into it. It's mm-hmm. just a very relevant thing to sort of trace from one type of film to another and see the different ways people respond to it.
So somehow, Alex, despite being put completely on the spot and caught off guard, you've delivered a better top five list than I'll have this week. So thanks for that.
No problem.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
I appreciate that. And I have seen all the films you mentioned except for the first one you guys mentioned. And now, obviously, I'm very curious. Nothing wrong with a little bit of cinema homework. So, again, guys.
I think it's out on DVD. I did a little thing for the special features of that film. I know it's never been available in America, so hopefully people can finally check it out. Another big one I just remembered that's a major film is Bergman's film The Touch with Elliot Gould. That film is just incredible, and Elliot Gould's character in that movie is just unbelievably
I've never seen that.
It's just such an incredible character and such an amazing film that, you know, basically caused Bergman to, you know, he renounced it, and I think it's probably my favorite film of his, and a really interesting film with an incredible character. I'd love to watch that movie back-to-back with Listen Up, Philip.
We'll list all of the films that Alex and Jason mentioned in our show notes over at filmspotting.net. Again, thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure talking with both of you, and best of luck with the film.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Is that the new book?
Yeah. Things are going to be pretty crazy for me after the release. Los Angeles in January, San Francisco, and the whole West Coast thing, really. I'm told to expect big things out there.
You sound like you're bragging.
That's because I am bragging.
My thanks again to Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman. In re-listening to that interview, at the end there, we're looking ahead to our top five movie narcissists, and he makes such an insightful point about how audiences, how we as viewers are willing to accept narcissists on screen when they're in a certain type of film, maybe more of a genre type film where there's a clear objective and they're obsessive about that objective and we cut them some slack. But in a film like this, we're maybe less inclined to cut some slack to someone who's so arrogant and off-putting.
Yeah, that's probably true. I didn't think about that way, but how many action movie heroes you could describe as narcissists, right?
For sure. So we're not going to dive into this film. I certainly covered most of what I appreciate about the movie in that long conversation, but you also got a chance to see it. What are your thoughts on Listen Up, Philip?
Yeah, I did. And I'm really glad that Perry opened this up to become something of a triptych, really, because these movies or movies that are centered on narcissists and are even critiquing of them, especially when the characters are artists of some kind, can strike me as self-indulgent. And sometimes that's the purpose. You know, they want to explore that area. So this movie opens up to consider the Elizabeth Moss character very much, opens up to consider the Jonathan Pryce character very much, and the whole picture just kind of blossomed with that decision, I felt. And he does this by sharing this interesting conceit of the voiceover narration, which is done by Eric Bogosian in these amusing, almost nature documentary tones, describing what the characters are thinking and their place in their life at that moment. And when the movie shifted and started doing that for Ashley, the Moss character, I thought that was great. And the same thing with Price. I mean, I think Schwartzman's really good here, too. I like him a ton. I think he's very funny, but I think you could say that a lot of what he does is more on a comic level in terms of maybe not caricature, but playing big personalities. This was a very human variation on what he does. Many of his characters are narcissists. We talked about Max Fisher, or you did in the interview.
Yeah.
But there's another sort of human element to it here. Perry's really good with actors. I mean, you saw that he was acting himself in The Color Wheel, but you also saw it with his co-star in The Color Wheel, Carlin Altman. She gives a great performance. And you see it again here. Not only Schwartzman, but Moss is fantastic. I mean, the highlight of the film for me probably is her performance. There is a moment after she
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Out of that apartment.
The camera lingers on her face.
The camera holds there, and what she goes through, it's not just that she's playing a number of different things in about 6 seconds.
Though she is.
She is, and that's admirable. But what she's ultimately playing is that character's deep uncertainty about what she's doing at that moment. And we're right there with her. We may not know exactly everything she's feeling or where it's going to go, but we know that she doesn't know.
Right.
And for an actress to pull that off is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. And Ross Perry talked about, obviously, during the interview, the decision to make a movie about what happens when this character leaves the room, but the world still goes on for all of these other characters. And that is sort of a jarring moment when you realize, oh, we're not just getting a little bit of insight into the Ashley character. It's going to stay with her for 20 or 30 minutes. And it follows nicely, actually. And we don't really have the time for it here, unfortunately. Maybe some bonus content down the road. But it follows nicely on the heels of our Gone Girl discussion the week before, I think, because we did talk a lot about the perceived misogyny of that film by some. And then you watch this movie where he does have female characters surrounding him almost at every point throughout the movie, and they're very beholden to the men in the film. And even when he's gone and we're spending time with the Ashley character, it's really all about the effect his absence has on her.
True.
And I felt myself at times resisting it, resisting the fact that it was probably honest, but I just wanted to say to her, wake up. Why are you pining for this guy? He's arrogant and obnoxious. But then you realize that the movie is willing to explore that kind of truth of a character who probably knows better than being with that person. But we all make those kind of decisions for whatever reason to stay with people we probably shouldn't stay with. And at the moment, with all of the female characters in this movie, where I think you might be inclined to write them off as one-dimensional and maybe not see them as strong enough women, there's a turn with all of them, and they surprise you.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the other thing Moss has to do here is show us what is appealing about Philip. I mean, the movie would fall apart if the guy was such a jerk that nobody could spend 5 minutes with him. Most people get sick of him after 5 minutes, but we also have to realize what's appealing. So Moss does that, and also Perry makes key decisions in the segments that are devoted to the Ashley character that are separate from Philip. We have the time spent when she goes home to visit her sister. That is dealing with different things than her relationship with him. And that scene when she goes out to a bar one night. Yes, she's going out because she's lonely now because she's alone, but picks up this guy, and the interaction there is a completely independent segment from anything going on with Philip. So the movie is definitely attuned to that, and I was grateful for it.
Listen Up, Philip, opens this weekend in New York City, and it will be available via VOD and iTunes rental on Tuesday, the 21st. And for Chicago listeners, Alex Ross Perry will be at the Music Box for its Chicago opening on October 24th.
Coming up, we'll share our lists of the movie's most memorable narcissists. Did you know Paris Hilton has more than 15 screen credits, Adam?
I did not.
Just thought I'd throw that out there in case you want to make any last-minute changes to your list. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by BuzzFeed's Allison Wilmore and Matt Singer of The Dissolve, focusing on the world of online movies.
More information at filmspottingsvu.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes.
Hello, Film Spotting Classic listeners. This is Matt Singer from Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, inviting you to check out our latest episode, which is dedicated to the films of David Cronenberg. Our listener's choice review is Cronenberg's 1981 film, Scanners.
Plus, we'll also recommend some other Cronenberg movies you can rent or stream at home right now. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes, at filmspottingsvu.com, or you just insert any stray VHS tape you have lying around into the flesh port in your chest.
Hi, my name's Steve Coogan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
It's like Samuel Beckett. You know, I admire the technique, but it doesn't hit me on a gut level.
I'd like to hit this guy on a gut level.
Stop it, Albie.
He's spitting on my neck. You know, he spits on my neck when he talks.
And you know something else? You know, you're so egocentric that if I miss my therapy, you can only think of it in terms of how it affects you.
It's Weltanschauung is what it is.
Probably on their first date, right? Probably met by answering an ad in the New York Review of Books. 30-ish academic wishes to meet woman who's interested in Mozart, James Joyce, and sodomy.
One of my favorite scenes from one of my favorite movies of all time, Woody Allen in Annie Hall. This is Film Spotting, and we're sharing our top five movie narcissists this week, inspired by our interview with Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman. Not that they're the narcissist, but the main character in their movie, Listen Up, Filler, certainly is. And when we threw this out on Twitter, Josh, you put out the call, which narcissist should we be sure to consider for our list? Many people threw out there that this should maybe be the Woody Allen memorial list. There are a number of narcissistic characters in his film. Certainly Woody usually embodies them, but we're not going with Annie Hall because it is in the Film Spotting pantheon, along with a few other movies that probably would qualify for this list. We'll get to some of those here in a moment. But Josh, start us off. Your number five and how you approached this list.
Well, I think we all have an idea, maybe partly formed from characters in the movies, of what a narcissist is. But I didn't know if that was correct, if that was the clinical definition. So I did look at some of the symptoms as described by the Mayo Clinic online. And I'm not going to list all of those. They were revealing, and it was pretty in line with what I thought, though it went well beyond self-love, you know, this regard for your physical appearance. It went into this idea that you were obsessively always prioritizing the self. I think that summed up most of the symptoms, and I think that definitely defines Philip, the Schwartzman character, mm-hmm. in Listen Up, Philip. Everything that happens in that movie, he's jockeying himself for position, either within his own head or in the actual real world. So that's what I used. My number five, though, starts more with the vanity idea, which is what I first went for, and I think maybe the reason for that is because what better imagery for narcissism in the movies, which is going to rely on images, than the mirror, right? Mm-hmm. So that led me to the Queen in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. This 1937 animated film, I think, gives us one of the movie's most iconic mirrors, maybe, that one with the ghostly face that appears to assure the evil queen that she is, yes, still the fairest in the land. The queen didn't actually make either my list or Tasha Robinson's of The Dissolve. When we talked top five Disney villains, that was on show 493. We were reviewing Maleficent, and maybe that was an oversight because the most indelible images for me, at least when I think about Snow White, they don't have a lot to do with the title heroine, or really, in my case, much to do with the dwarves. I think, first of all, about that mournful face in the mirror. I think the queen calls it the slave in the mirror, which has a lot of implications there. And also, I think of the vain countenance of the evil queen as she peers into it.
Slave in the magic mirror, come from the farthest space, through wind. In darkness, I summon thee. Speak. Let me see thy face.
What wouldst thou know, my queen?
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
I mean, talk about narcissism. What kind of person would have a mirror on hand that essentially gives them a personal hot or not rating every day that you have to go check? But it may seem insane. I don't know. In this day and age, you know, when we have selfies, I can imagine someone inventing some sort of app like that. Maybe that's what social media can function like for some people. Is Facebook, who of my friends looks better than me today? I mean, we probably do that to some degree. The lesson here, Adam, we're all evil queens.
I'm not going to say at all whether or not you just perfectly described my usage of Facebook, okay. But you might be close.
All right,
Josh. In addition to Alvy Singer from Annie Hall, you heard Jason Schwartzman mention The Wizard of Oz at the end of our interview. Certainly a movie and a character that are worthy of consideration, but in the pantheon, a giant of a figure named Charles Foster Kane from Citizen Kane, that's off limits. And really, when you think about it, and I'm sure I'm missing some other ones from the pantheon, but who's a bigger narcissist in all of cinema history than Noah Cross from Chinatown? I mean, if you think about what he does and why he does it.
Yeah, right, the motivation.
So we couldn't pick him, though, because he is in the Film Spotting Pantheon. A couple penalty box picks, movies that I've just brought up too often recently, or over all time of doing this show. Joe Gideon from All That Jazz playing the Bob Fosse character absolutely qualifies. Barton from Barton Fink, a movie I love from the Coen brothers. And Jack Torrance from The Shining, who was a pick that Alex Ross Perry on Twitter after our interview added to the conversation.
He did,
someone that he forgot. So all those people are ineligible. And I ruled out a few more because I went to a top five that I think maybe you were a part of, Josh. I didn't look at the show number, I guess, but it was top five movies about fame. And obviously that ambition for fame,
I think we did do that together,
that carries with it a certain vanity, right? A certain ego. And I didn't want to cover the same ground, but Chuck Tatum from Billy Wilder's amazing film, Ace in the Hole, Rupert Pupkin from Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, and Suzanne Stone from To Die For, the Nicole Kidman character.
I thought
also,
about that one.
Also great pick. So set those aside, still had to define, as you did, what I really thought narcissism meant. And you're right, you Google it immediately, the first thing that comes up is excessive or erotic interest in oneself and one's physical appearance. That is what we usually think of. But that second definition, I think, is the more interesting one. Extreme selfishness with a grandiose view of one's own talents and a craving for admiration. Being vain, for me, as I made my list, wasn't enough. That craving for admiration really was the key. That need, that almost pathological need to be appreciated, is what really jumped out for me. And that's how you distinguish, I think, between someone who is arrogant, who is cocky, who is overconfident, like maybe a Gordon Gekko character from Wall Street. He does have a grandiose view of his talents, for sure, but I'm not sure he really cares what others think of him. Same with a guy like Daniel Plainview from There Will Be Blood. And it's hard not to think of narcissism and not go immediately to a figure like Klaus Kinski. In every Werner Herzog film, especially a movie like Aguirre, The Wrath of God, there's an element of narcissism to him, but he's not a character who actually, when he has the chance to become the ruler of his group, he doesn't want it. He doesn't want that figurehead position. He doesn't care what others think of him. He is just singularly driven and obsessive, and I think that's a little bit different. So I ruled out vanity as really the main component of my picks, but that doesn't mean it didn't matter. And certainly, a perfect companion to your number five pick is my number five, lots of mirror shots in this movie, including our introduction to the character Patrick Bateman from American Psycho, Mary Harron's 2000 film, adapted, of course, from the famous Bret Easton Ellis novel. He puts an ice pack on his face if he's a little puffy in the morning while he does his stomach crunches. I know that's a morning routine you share, Josh,
yes,
as well.
I got to pick up an extra ice pack when I get home. Thanks for reminding me.
I love how in the voiceover he points out that he has this routine and he can do 1,000 crunches now. It's very important that we as viewers understand that. We hear all about his rigorous shower ritual.
I always use an aftershave lotion with little or no alcohol, because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look older. Then moisturizer, then an anti-aging eye balm, followed by a final moisturizing protective lotion. There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
That's striving to be something he's not, erasing the something he is. I think that is a key component of narcissism. There's this fractured identity. And that certainly comes through in the famous business card scene from the movie as well, with Jared Leto confusing him for someone else. I'd never really caught on to that before. I was always just paying attention to how funny it is, how absurd it is that they're jockeying over the type of paper they're using and the type of print they're using on their business cards. But the fact that the Jared Leto character comes up to him and confuses him for someone else, someone who's also in the room, who looks the same, who wears the same suits, works for the same company, has the same job. It's as if that identity really doesn't exist at all, or he's always struggling to carve it out. And I found on another website talking about narcissism, they said the narcissist creates a false self to interact with the world that shamed him. And that notion of shame, I think it applies certainly in some ways, the idea of the false self, but shame is going to run through a lot of my picks as well. And I think you also just have to have at least one sociopath on a list like this, because how can you not call them narcissists? They're creating their own moral universes. In this case, one in which Invisible Touch is the undisputed masterpiece by the band Genesis, and I don't want to live in that world.
You know what we're back to? Again, Gone Girl. I mean,
yeah,
the narcissism and sociopath hand in hand, right?
Indeed.
All right, number four for me is the character called Aydin from Winter Sleep. This played just this week at the Chicago International Film Festival, and I got a chance to see it as part of that. It is as rich as we hoped, both being huge fans of Nuri Bilge Ceylan's previous film, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. This is perhaps not quite as dense because it's much more focused. You could call it a character study of a controlling narcissist named Aydin. He's played by Haluk Belgunash. Aydin is a prominent, affable landowner who owns this boutique hotel for international tourists. It's in this remote Turkish region of Cappadocia. He's something of an unofficial mayor, yet he holds this position with a narcissistic grip, with real control. And I think this is a mark you can see in some of these characters, too, the need to control others. He's only concerned with his own comforts, his own habits, his own thoughts. As a matter of fact, he was a former actor, we're told. Now he pontificates on matters he doesn't really know much about for an opinion column that runs in the local newspaper. He still needs that pulpit and an audience out there. This has gradually alienated everyone around him, and this is something that finally dawns on him over the course of this long, cold off-season. The hotel at this point is mainly empty, one or two guests here or there, but it's just him otherwise, his bitter sister, his deferential handyman, and then his younger, suffocated wife. As Aydin, Bilgunash is a real force because this is a movie that runs over 3 hours, but he's the reason that it holds you. For Anatolia, for me, it was those landscapes that just kept me enthralled, and Bilgunash is really the force here. He's charming and insufferable in equal measure. He has this dismissive chuckle that it just drives you absolutely crazy every time he does it. And even though he has this air of confidence, though, he seems dazed by his place in the world a little bit, and he trudges about this property, wears this trench coat, and it looks like the gown of a weary Monarch. There's a lot more to Winter Sleep, but I know you probably feel like you've heard too much already, Adam, so I'm not going to go on just to say that it does live up to the majority of our expectations, and it is supposed to open after playing the festivals it has so far at Cannes, now Chicago International. At the end of the year, it's supposed to come to a few U.S. theaters, so hopefully people will have a chance to check it out.
I was going to say that I'd tell you it sounds like a great pick, but I tuned out everything you said.
Understand.
And just started looking ahead to my number four. And I told you before we started recording that this number four pick, if it wasn't on your list, and I don't think it is, then I don't know how to explain it. Either you just overlooked it, mm-hmm. or you considered it but wrote it off because it's a movie you've expressed a lot of love for in the past.
Okay.
It is Apocalypse Now and one Colonel Kurtz.
Oh, wow. Didn't even consider it.
Really?
No.
Just
but I like it.
Let's think about it, right? You talk about Patrick Bateman and those sociopathic characters creating their own moral universe, often in a kind of abstract way. Colonel Kurtz literally yep. creates his own moral world. He goes into the jungle and becomes a god. And becoming a god in that world may involve putting some heads on stakes to warn some people away as they're coming up, or just to celebrate as trophies as they come up to his territory. And I love Dennis Hopper, the line he says to the Martin Sheen character Willard, the heads, you're looking at the heads. Sometimes he goes too far. He'd be the first one to admit it. So there's at least a little bit of humility to this narcissistic god who we hear in a quote from Willard at one point say, as for the charges against me, I am unconcerned. I am beyond their timid, lying morality, and so I am beyond caring. What sums up the narcissistic spirit better than that? Truly seeing the world as one that only involves your view of it. Now, if I wanted to cheat a little bit and have some fun, I would throw onto this list not just Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now, but one Francis Ford Coppola from the documentary Hearts of Darkness. About the making of Apocalypse Now, because he very famously said at one point, my movie is not about Vietnam, my movie is Vietnam.
Yeah.
And we talk about playing God. If Marty dies, I want to hear that everything's okay until I say Marty is dead. That's what happened to him out in that jungle. And as he describes it, too much equipment, too much money, too many people. Too much of everything, and it eventually went to their heads, and they lost it a little bit, just like Kurtz did.
Except that you could argue still, not that he wasn't perhaps crazed, but wasn't he still elevating the art above himself to some degree? I mean, that was the goal, was making the film. So,
I agree.
Yeah. Kurtz, that's great, though.
Okay.
Are you an assassin? I'm a soldier. You're neither. You're an errand boy, sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill.
All right, number three is Kim from Rachel Getting Married. Anne Hathaway, she was gunning for Oscars well before she won for Les Miserables in 2012. And an earlier Go for Broke performance, one that actually was Oscar nominated, was in Jonathan Demme's 2008 dysfunctional family drama, Rachel Getting Married. She plays Kim, and that's spelled with a Y, you should know. So she was sort of cursed to see herself as needing to be set apart and above others. Kim takes a leave from a drug rehab program to attend her sister's wedding, played by Rosemary DeWitt, and she ends up making the entire event all about her.
Hello. Relax, it's Seltzer. Hello. I am Sheba the Destroyer and your harbinger of doom for this evening. I would like to thank you all for coming and welcome you, even though I haven't seen most of you since my latest stretch in the big house. But you all look fabulous.
It turns out that her narcissism is in part tied to a real tragedy in Kim's past, or at least her current behavior. But we also learn that she has a habit of inventing tragedies to evoke pity and garner attention. So it's an incredibly complicated psychology going on here. This is admittedly a deglamming performance, you know, when an attractive actor goes grungy. But it's more than a gimmick, I think. Hathaway, she doesn't hide her beauty here so much as damage it, and she gives us a mixture of shame and defensiveness and terror. That combination is almost always in her panicked eyes. And she also gives each scene this prickly edge. You really want to strangle her at parts, but you do pity her. And I think the key of the performance is that Hathaway doesn't seem concerned with either winning the audience's sympathy or creating this despicable anti-hero. And she's living on screen. And you can feel that. At least I did. I think it's a really good performance. There's another
it's
one
a great performance
in this film that's really strong along similar lines I could have picked for the list. That's Deborah Winger as Kim's mother. It's possible she's the source of the family's narcissism.
Yeah.
We get a few scenes with her that are crucial to the film.
Haven't seen that movie since it came out, like so many movies reviewed here on the show, unfortunately, but remember loving it.
You did like
sure,
it.
Sure, I had it in my top 10 of the year, and I love that performance as well. My number three, I thought it was important, Josh, to have at least one pick on my list that's a character you can laugh at. A narcissist you can have some fun
sure.
with at their expense. And it came down to two choices here, both obnoxious criminals, and their arrogance ends up being the end of them, so to speak. And one of them I considered but didn't go with was Vizzini from The Princess
yeah.
Bride, who says he's
thought
smarter than Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. But I had to go with one of my favorite comedic performances of all time, Kevin Klein as Otto in A Fish Called Wanda. And I've mentioned this notion of shame coming through some of these picks, being this underlying aspect of narcissism. Don't ever, ever call me stupid. We hear Otto say all the time. He thinks he's brilliant. He projects himself as this brilliant, sophisticated man, but it really is just trying to cover up his tremendous insecurity and also stupidity. Apes don't read philosophy, the Jamie Lee Curtis character says to him at one point. And I think that is important because it's not about the philosophy, the Nietzsche he's reading. It's just about holding the book for other people to see and appearing to be so smart. It's also important to point out how many times he uses some form of a line like, you stupid, stiff, pompous English, or he references how superior the British people think they are. His ego just can't handle them potentially beating him at anything. And I do love about Otto that he's an equal opportunity offender. His condescension really goes for all walks of life. It doesn't just cover British people. He calls fish insects and quotes Nietzsche, at least he thinks he's quoting Nietzsche. I'm not sure if it's truly from him or not, as calling all animals God's second blunder.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you? Well, would you like to know where you'd be without us, the old US of A, to protect you? I'll tell you, the smallest province in the Russian Empire. That's what. So don't call me stupid, lady. Just thank me.
Well, thank you for popping in and protecting us.
If it wasn't for us, you'd all be speaking German, singing Deutschland, Deutschland, Uberein.
So he really thinks he is the best thing in the universe and would love to rule over everybody if he could, but that's not how things work out for poor Otto.
Yeah, and the kicker for Otto is that he's fooling no one, right? So but he just charges ahead anyway. All right, my number two is a classic pick, probably should be my number one. It's the more respectable choice, but I went in a different direction for number one. Number two, though, is Norman Desmond from Sunset Boulevard. Gloria Swanson's Norma, she doesn't have a mirror like the Evil Queen in Snow White, but she does have her old silent movies, which she obsessively watches in her mansion. This is Billy Wilder's 1950 noir melodrama, of course, and perhaps it's the definitive take on Hollywood narcissism, or at least how narcissism plays out in a business that's built on public image and in some ways adoration. Just think about what Norma is doing when she first meets William Holden's Joe Gillis, the disillusioned screenwriter. She's writing a script about Salome, and of course, she plans to star. So you've got that self-delusion going on there. She insists that Gillis move into her mansion as a script doctor, and that's how he gets caught up in this doomed comeback attempt. Narcissists often need an enabler, and Sunset Boulevard provides one in Eric von Stroheim's Max. He's Norma's butler and the real author of the fan letters that she receives. Later, we actually learn that he was once a director who initially discovered Norma, made her a star, married her, and was then dumped by her, yet is still hanging around as her servant.
What about the studio? What about DeMille?
He was trying to spare your feelings. The studio only wanted to rent your car.
Wanted what?
DeMille didn't have the heart to tell you. None of us has had the heart.
That's a lie. They want me. I get letters every day.
You tell her, Max. Come on, do her that favor. Tell her there isn't going to be any picture. There aren't any fan letters except the ones you write.
That isn't true. Max!
Madame is the greatest star of them all. I will take Mr. Gillis's bags to the car.
This deeply unhealthy scenario eventually erupts in one of the most famous movie finales of all time, in which Norma, via murder, ensures that her comeback scenario is going to happen. It is going to come true, or at least some deranged version of it. And thinking about that finale, especially the newsreel cameras that are on hand to capture her infamous close-up, I couldn't help but be reminded again of Gone Girl. Definitely a little touch of that there.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to shake Gone Girl, I think, for most of the year. I think it's just one of those films that is going to stick with us. And if I didn't know you were going with Norma Desmond, no doubt she would have found a place on my list. I love that film, Sunset Boulevard. And for my number two, I'm going to stick with Classic Hollywood and about the same time period, I believe just about 7 years before. And that's Mildred Pierce and Vida Pierce. I think one good test of a movie narcissist is how badly do you want them to see them get, to go back to the Magnificent Ambersons and Alex Ross Perry, to get their comeuppance. And there are few characters in movie history I was waiting to see get punished than Vida. Mildred has two daughters. They both end up causing their mother pain and suffering, though only one of them does it by choice. That's Vida. The other one is Kay. Just perfectly sweet and innocent. And then there's the selfish, vile Vida. And of course, she's the one who sticks around to really wreak havoc on her mom. Mildred is a housewife and she separates from her husband who's unemployed and she has to get a job. She has to provide for the family, the two daughters that she has custody of. And it's clear right away that Vida is just this social climber. That's really all she's interested in, is getting out of wherever she is right now. And she seems especially concerned with money. As much money and nice clothing and how beautiful she can look, that really seems to be her only obsessions. And Mildred ends up getting a job as a waitress, and she has to hide that from Vida because she knows that Vida will look down on her because of that. She eventually goes on to open her own restaurant and is incredibly successful, but that doesn't matter. That somehow is not enough to wash the stink off, is really how Vida seems to view it. It's not really so much about the money. It's never been about the money. It's about somehow rising above her position in life and how she thinks she's perceived by others.
All right, Vida, from now on, things are going to be different.
I'll say they're going to be different. Why do you think I went to all this trouble? Why do you think I want money so badly?
All right, why?
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
Then I'll tell you. With this money, I can get away from you.
Vida.
From you and your chickens and your pies and your kitchens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from this shack with its cheap furniture and this town and its dollar days and its women that wear uniforms and its men that wear overalls.
Vida, I think I'm really seeing you for the first time in my life, and you're cheap and horrible.
This is a woman who gets money from a boy by lying to him about being pregnant. And going back to the whole creating your own moral universe, she says about being pregnant when her mother just asks her whether or not it's true. At this stage, it's a matter of opinion. And in my opinion, I'm going to have a baby. So she can sort of just make up truth from moment to moment because her truth is the only truth that matters. And you get a great juxtaposition in that film of the ultimate narcissist and the ultimate non-narcissist in the form of Joan Crawford's Mildred. Everything she does has nothing to do with her. It's always just been about trying to please Vida. And of course, that's the real tragedy of the film, is it doesn't matter. She never can.
Yeah, I definitely thought about Vida. I had her and Crawford on our top five movie mother-daughters list.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why I stayed away from that one. But great pick. My number one, well, narcissism is the fuel, I think, on which so much of Will Ferrell's comedy runs. I mean, think about his minor league basketball player in Semi-Pro, his fading figure skater in Blades of Glory, his NASCAR superstar in Talladega Nights, all good options. But I'm going with self-important local news anchor Ron Burgundy. Anchorman, it's not necessarily my favorite Ferrell comedy. Anchorman 2, even less so. But I do think Burgundy is the best distillation of his narcissistic persona. It's his definitive pompous dimwit. The layers of persona building that go into this character are just astounding. So many absurd details that we get. And all of them, if you take them all apart and look at them, they're geared toward creating this tone-deaf image of an enviable man. So you've got the scotch, right? That's what a real man would do. The smoking jacket, the jazz flute. I mean, really, that's all you need to become the world's most interesting man, right? Even Burgundy's newscasts are less informational. They start informational, but then they go off into these odd segue tangents that are random personal stories, all to prop himself up. So he uses those moments just to build this image. Anchorman is built around a threat to this narcissism. The plot, the little plot that we get, has to do with this new co-anchor played by Christina Applegate, who comes on the scene. And Ron Burgundy gets maniacally defensive when she arrives, even when they're on air together.
Well, for all of us here at Channel 4 News, I'm Ron Burgundy. You stay classy, San Diego.
And thanks for stopping by.
But mainly, stay classy.
Thanks for stopping by.
Stay classy, I'm Ron Burgundy.
Thanks for stopping by.
Stay classy. Ron Burgundy. You are a real hooker, and I'm going to slap you in public.
You have way too much pubic hair.
Actually, that's a point of pride. I'm very proud of my mane of pubic hair, so thank you.
I knew there would come a time when Will Ferrell would take a number one slot on a top five list. Adam, this is it.
I can't believe it's taken this long.
It took a little while, but I got there.
If there was going to be a list, this one is it. You're absolutely right. My number one, I don't really need to say anything about it. I think I can just play this scene.
Is that a question?
In the 16th email, you raised concerns about the site's functionality. Were you leading them on for 6 weeks?
No.
Then why didn't you raise any of these concerns before?
It's raining.
I'm sorry?
It just started raining.
Mr. Zuckerberg, do I have your full attention?
No.
Do you think I deserve it?
What?
Do you think I deserve your full attention?
I had to swear an oath before we began this deposition, and I don't want to perjure myself, so I have a legal obligation to say no.
Okay, no. You don't think I deserve your attention?
I think if your clients want to sit on my shoulders and call themselves tall, they have a right to give it a try. But there's no requirement that I enjoy sitting here listening to people lie. You have part of my attention. You have the minimum amount. The rest of my attention is back at the offices of Facebook, where my colleagues and I are doing things that no one in this room, including and especially your clients, are intellectually or creatively capable of doing. Did I adequately answer your condescending question?
Mark Zuckerberg. From The Social Network, as played by Jesse Eisenberg in his Oscar-nominated turn. I don't have to say anything, but of course I will add a few words. It's all there in that scene. Everything we've talked about through these picks so far is there. That disregard and disdain he has for the opposing counsel, the disregard and disdain he has for the Winklevi, and the suggestion, that inflated sense of himself, that grandiosity, the suggestion that his company is doing the type of work nobody in that room or probably any other room in America is capable of. If you go back to the very beginning of that movie, that conversation with Erica Albright, he says to her, "You've seen guys who row crew." And she says, "No." And he says, "Well, they're bigger than me. They're world-class athletes. And a second ago, you said that you like guys who row crew, so I assumed you'd met one." And she says, "I guess I just meant I like the idea of it the way a girl likes cowboys." It makes me think of your comments about Ron Burgundy and striving for this sort of idealized image of a man that he puts on. I think that's certainly what's driving some of that insecurity with a character like Mark Zuckerberg, who is constantly striving. His narcissism is driven by that striving to get into one of those finals clubs that he thinks is somehow going to lead to a better life, as if that was the answer to it all. Sean Parker, the Justin Timberlake character, I think you could also probably consider a narcissist, but I think what we see of him anyway is he's just one of those guys who's very cocky and very arrogant. We never really get the sense of what's driving him, though, beyond that arrogance. We definitely get it with the Mark Zuckerberg character. And he has to be, Josh, one of the most, if not likable, narcissists on screen. Entertaining.
Yeah, that's the word that popped to mind.
Narcissist.
He's fun to
screen.
Watch.
And that scene that, of course, we just played is one of the key examples of that, where just that kind of that banter, that Sorkin banter and that snappiness to it, even though he's being really unnecessarily cruel, it's fun to listen to.
And in the context of your list, Eisenberg plays Zuckerberg as the Colonel Kurtz of the internet.
Yes, he does.
You know, he's staking out this village and making
Facebook
his own
rules.
Facebook
is the jungle.
Exactly.
That's right. Those are our top five movie narcissists. Josh, what about any honorable mentions?
Well, so many Wes Anderson characters come to mind.
And
but
that's
I
what
just,
I put. So many Wes Anderson characters.
I mean, you could just pick a handful of them. But I just had Moonrise Kingdom on my last list of top five movie missives, so I decided to take a break. That way, I didn't have to choose between Dignan or Max Fisher or Steve Zissou or M. Gustav or Foxy. Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark in Iron Man, thought about. Jep in the Great Beauty. This is a recent La Dolce Vita variation from Italy with Tony Servillo as an aging, self-promoting society journalist. Thought about Kirsten Dunst, Marie Antoinette from Sofia Coppola. Wallace Shawn's Vizzini, you mentioned in The Princess Bride, would have been great for this list. And this one I love that came from Austin Lugar on Twitter, Miss Piggy. But, you know, I talk about the Muppets a lot, so.
Yes, you do. We heard from him earlier in the show. I definitely consider Jeff Daniels Bernard from The Squid and the Whale. Norma Desmond did get some consideration. Eve Harrington from All About Eve had to at least be in the mix. And as we're going down the sociopath serial killer list, John Doe from David Fincher's Seven, Jasmine from Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine, not one of my favorite Woody Allen films, but man, Cate Blanchett nails a certain type
of
narcissism.
There's a lot of stuff going on there beyond narcissism, I think.
Yeah, that's true. And in addition to Wes Anderson featuring a lot of narcissists, how about Paul Thomas Anderson, Frank T.J. Mackey, Tom Cruise in Magnolia, Lancaster Dodd in The Master, and yes, Daniel Plainview as well in There Will Be Blood. So just a few of those names that we considered but didn't make the final cut for our top five movie narcissists. We want to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Or you can leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, and find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Help boost Mark Zuckerberg's ego. Visit facebook.com/filmspotting.
There you go.
There are a lot of movies coming out here, Josh. I don't know if we're really going to get to them all, but opening wide and in limited release this weekend, The Book of Life. It's an animated Romeo and Juliet story set against the Mexican Day of the Dead celebration. Diego Luna and Zoe Saldana are two of the voices, as well as Channing Tatum. Fury, big release. Brad Pitt. This is not an animated Romeo and Juliet movie. It's a tank movie set in World War II from director David Ayer, who recently directed End of Watch.
Which we split on, I believe. I wasn't too fond of it.
I didn't love End of Watch. I think I was right in the middle on End of Watch. Okay. Liked it a little bit more than you. Out in limited release, opening in Chicago this weekend, 20,000 Days on Earth. This is a semi-fictional doc about a day in the life of Nick Cave. That's playing here at Facets at the Gene Siskel Film Center. Expedition to the End of the World, which I really highlight mainly because Sam pulled this comment from our friend David Ehrlich, who says about this documentary about a group of Danish artists who set out to explore the last white areas of the world map. It courses with the zeal of Robert Flaherty, the fearlessness of Werner Herzog, and the fatalistic humor of Lars von Trier.
That is a combination.
I mean, who doesn't want to see that movie? Also out in limited release, Young Ones. This is a post-apocalyptic tale starring our guy, Michael Shannon.
The aged.
Nicholas Holt. The ageless. Michael Shannon.
Ageless.
I'm going to go with ageless instead of aged. Try to make him feel better. Elle Fanning also. And St. Vincent is out. This is Josh Larson's number one most anticipated thing of the fall. Bill Murray share scenes with Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah, it still sounds good to me.
Whiplash also opening, the young drummer and his hard-ass teacher, J.K. Simmons. That is the movie we are planning on discussing next week on the show. And in conjunction with that, we're going to share our top five mentor-protege relationships. If you have any great ideas, any strong candidates for that list, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week is from Typefighter, a garage pop band from Washington, D.C. Was actually recommended from listener Andrew Butler, who's in Film Spotting East, Arlington, Virginia. You can find more information about them at typefightermusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Now, I don't know. Oh, this scene was found?
I found it.
You found it?
Yeah. It's like, it's kind of a bad...
Do we have to snarl at each other?
Well, that's why I wanted to find it.
Yeah, I
did. I had like the voices in my head. I didn't have the snarling or the... My suggestion would be...
Don't watch it?
One of us snarls and one of us kind of hisses. And I think we'll get at the right mix there.
I love it. Okay. I want to see if I can hear it, though.
See? Hissing. I think the real question here is not who do you want to play, but do you want to snarl or hiss?
I want to hiss.
You're going to hiss?
No,
okay.
Yeah. There's no way I could snarl.
All right.
Oh, my God.
I'll snarl, you hiss.
Wow.